So we want to welcome everyone, and not only those here, but those who are watching over the internet too. It's fun to see old friends who we haven't seen for a while.
Are there any there? If there's, I see people standing. There are empty seats, why don't you? There are two in front. Are those taken? So just come and grab a seat if you'd like to sit. And there's one over back there, I think. And okay. So we wanted to also, before we start the class per se, to share just a little bit about India. We got back on Tuesday night, and it was really a wonderful trip. Swamiji sends his love to all of you. He's doing quite well, and he hopes to come back here at the beginning of May and stay perhaps through September. We don't know, but a good long stay. And our time in India, we wrote one letter that maybe some of you have seen. It was a very, very blessed time. And we went to parts of India we'd never been to before. And the trip to Kanyakumari on the very tip, southernmost tip of India, was really amazing. We were looking on our Google map, and you actually could zero in on that little rock and see the temples on that little rock. So it's fascinating.
Kanyakumari, for those of you who don't know, is a very ancient temple dedicated to Parvati. Actually, the temple there that we visited was only 2,000 years old, and it was built on the site of the earlier temple. So. it's where three oceans come together, the very southern tip. So they think of it as the ocean embracing the land at that point. And as I say, there's an ancient temple dedicated to Parvati, but also there's a very sacred spot because it's where Vivekananda, who is the chief disciple of Ramakrishna, after Ramakrishna's death, Vivekananda was uncertain of what his mission in life should be. And so he took a pilgrimage where he walked the length of India. And when he finally arrived at the very southern tip of India, there, a couple of hundred yards, maybe 300 yards off the tip of India, was the last bit of Indian soil, which was this island. And so he swam out to it. We took a boat, and that was scary enough, so Vivekananda must have been quite the swimmer. At any rate, he went out there, and he meditated on that rock for three solid days. And during that time, it came to him that what he needed to dedicate his life to was restoring India to its ancient spiritual roots, that it had drifted away from that, and especially during the British occupation, had drifted away from its true purpose in life. And Swami has often said that India is the guru of the world. And that rededication of India to its spiritual roots is also timely in Dwapara Yuga, because it's the rededication of the guru of the world back to spirituality and away from the changeover from Kali Yuga.
Then we spent, we had a week kind of rest in a very nice resort area called Goa. And then the rest of our time was in the Pune community, which is really moving forward. It has a long way to go. There are many problems. We won't go into the details here. But
Ananda, 1971.
But what is beautiful, what was happening while we were there was the equivalent of our Living Discipleship Program. They call it Community Training Program. And so the people that are will be moving there permanently, about 30 of them came. And some of them had young children, some of them had come from Gurgaon, from Mumbai, from Pune City. And it was a wonderful gathering of both the people in India as well as people from all of our communities. Anand and Uma were there from Assisi, Jyotish and I, Durga Madura from here, Asha from Palo Alto, I think that was kind of the spread of it. And then, of course, the teachers, those living in India, Dharmadasa Nirmala,
and
Jai and Sadhana. And there is a shift in what's going on in India. Dharmadasa Nirmala, after 8 years there, will be going on to Assisi, and Jaya and Sadhana will be the spiritual directors of the Pune community, and Dhyana, the spiritual director of what they call NCR, National Capital Region, which includes Delhi and Gurgaon and all the outlying areas. So a lot of changes, but we had a wonderful 10 days there of classes, and the caliber of the people that are coming to that community, it was really overwhelming. They're such beautiful, beautiful souls and making tremendous sacrifices. There's a couple, and then maybe we'll close with this because we don't want to talk too much about this, but who had lived in Delhi, and they both had very high-level jobs, their husband and wife. Ashish is the man, Archana is the woman. They have a 10-year-old daughter, Neha. They left their jobs to volunteer full-time to help Dhyana. And now Swamiji has asked them to be the community managers in Pune. And we were asking them a little bit about what their background was. One could see they were shining devotees, but Archana has a master's degree in international finance, so I think she can deal with what we have going on.
Handle the books at Pune.
Yeah, right. And then we asked Ashish what he did. Very humble, humble man, probably mid to late 30s. And he said, well, I'm a geophysicist. I was in charge of oil drilling for India Oil, in charge of Asia. And we thought, oh, okay.
Probably qualifies him to look for water on the
home. But they left that world behind them to just volunteer or whatever happens for the rest of their life to serve Master with their daughter. And that's the caliber of the people that are coming. And just remarkable, humble, selfless people. And it was such a joy to be with them and to do what we could to share our experiences of building Ananda so they wouldn't be dismayed at the challenges of it all. So anyway, maybe that's...
I think so. Just to close with the thought that it was very gratifying because naturally our desire is to see, to be in tune with God's will, which in this case is to see the idea of self-realization, Master's Ray, spread throughout the world, and to see it really now rooted back again in his homeland is very gratifying. And you can see that the base now is solid enough so it can really begin to grow from here. Okay, well.
Do you want tea?
Yes. I might cough from time to time. I am in the final stages of recovering from some bronchial illness that I
not
have.
The final stages of tuberculosis, as
no. Not consumption, as
consumption.
They put it. No, I've got some cough drops, thank you. But it's hard to suck on them and talk at the same time. So,
you can do it.
But thank you. So this morning, as Davy said, we're going to talk about life. And birth today, life tomorrow, death on Wednesday. Then if you don't get the point, we'll start with birth again on Thursday. Life on Friday, death on Saturday, and on it goes. As Swamiji has pointed out, one of his cartoons that he very much enjoyed was this doctor and nurse looking over this nursery where there were dozens of babies. I bring this to mind because Davy and I have a new grandson as of last night. But can't take a whole lot of credit for this, you know. But the doctor and nurse looking over all these babies and the doctor saying, when will it ever end? When? And so it goes on, this cycle of life and birth and rebirth. And it's the nearly endless story. It isn't endless, thank goodness, because for each of us, well, it is endless. But the birth and rebirth part is going to come to an end. But it will continue on. Because as Master said, it goes on and on and on until it achieves endlessness, until we reunite with that which is infinite and that which is beyond time and space. So the story of it all is that God is pure consciousness, and he projects his consciousness into the world in terms of manifestation, in terms of creation. And in that creation, it is incredibly complex, far, far beyond what we can even begin to perceive, because there are hundreds of billions of galaxies with hundreds of billions of stars. And now scientists even are saying that maybe some of those stars actually have planets. Whoa, now there's a new idea. And on the ticklish edge of fanaticism in science is that maybe some of those planets have life on them. Well, Master said, not only do planets, is the universe filled with planets, filled with life, but life is everywhere. Life doesn't have to wait until it has a nice Earth-like planet with water and an oxygen kind of atmosphere. Master said there's life in the middle of stars, in the center of stars. Life is everywhere. God's consciousness is everywhere. So this enormous, complex thing of the universe is just a little basket hanging beneath the balloon of the astral universe. And that's tiny compared to the causal universe. And all three of those are finite. And then God beyond is infinite. So this enormously vast, complex thing is going on. And on the other hand, it seems so vast and so complex, but in essence, it's very, very simple. As Sri Yukteswar said to Master, God is simple. All else is complex. You know, the whole vast galaxy and galaxies and everything, it's held together by some very, very simple little laws. God doesn't have to be like the train scheduler and look at everything. This planet needs to be here at this point. And reminds me of a bus driver in England who was called up in front of his company superiors because the passengers were complaining that he didn't stop for them. And his solution, his answer to this charge was, well, of course I don't stop. If I stopped, I'd get off schedule. Well, this God doesn't have to do all this complex mental scheduling. He just does it with momentum and gravity. That's why Master one time asked Swamiji, why does the Earth go around the sun? And Swami said, well, it goes around the sun because of the centripetal force. It's got a momentum. And he said, well, then why doesn't it fly off into space? And Swami thought, well, I'll give him a little bit of basic astrology here, or astronomy. It doesn't fly off into space because of the force of gravity that pulls it. And the two forces are balanced together, and that's why we have an orbit around it. And Master said, oh, thank you very much. Took Swami 6 months to figure out that Master knew very well this basic astrology. What he was asking was about us. Why don't we fall into the bosom of God? Well, because we have this outward momentum. Then why don't we fly off? because there's an attractive force that brings us back. And according to how much outward momentum we have still built up, we have a larger orbit or a closer orbit, or we're about ready to crash into the sun and be absorbed into light again. But this ongoing drama of life and birth and death and the continuing cycle of that. So it's all an expression of consciousness. Everything is consciousness. There's nothing made in the world that is made of anything other than consciousness. And while it seems complex, it's really very simple. The basic law that God uses, simple little law, is that every particle of this consciousness that goes out and is spread everywhere, every tiny little particle is seeking reunion with that from which it comes, from God's consciousness. And the fact that God's consciousness is infinite and eternal, but is also one more quality. It's blissful. And because of that, every atom in creation is endowed with the desire to find bliss. And that desire, that's really the gravity that is drawing us back. On a farther scale out, it doesn't seem like we're going to achieve bliss, but we can work toward and achieve happiness. And I heard some teacher's explanation or definition of bliss, which I don't agree with, but it's a pretty good working model for directional. He said, bliss is happiness without any cause. So happiness without any cause is bliss. We're used to happiness with a cause. We seek to, achieve something. We achieve it and we're happy. Or a son is born to our son and our name continues on and so we're very happy. So on and on it goes. A condition is set up, and if that condition is met, then we're happy. But what if there is no condition? What if there is no desire for something and we're happy anyway? Well, that's the beginning of a sense of bliss. The reason it isn't really bliss is because it still denotes an I and a condition, or even here a conditionless condition and a kind of vibration of happiness, whereas real bliss is innate in the very nature of us. So when all conditions are removed, it's not that they haven't just haven't been met, but when all conditions are removed, what we find is our innate nature is blissful. Well, the whole drama of life, birth, rebirth is the continuing, one could say, seeking after that bliss and the gradual refinement so that the conditions that we put on it are gradually removed more and more completely until there are no more conditions. The last condition is that of separateness, of the idea that we are separate from other elements in this creation. That isn't our fault that we have that thought, by the way. So don't feel guilty about it. It's the way that God keeps creation. If there weren't the thought of separateness, then everything would merge together and merge back into God, and there wouldn't be any creation. So in order to do that, he has to create that idea of separateness. In Sanskrit, that's called Maya, and it actually means the measurer, that which separates and can measure. And so the force of Maya keeps us feeling the sense of separateness. It's a universal force. But we can tune into that in deeper ways, more ways that keep us more stuck, or we can gradually try to extract ourselves from that sense of separation. When the desire to extract yourself from a sense of separation comes, that is when it could be said that you have really come consciously onto the spiritual path. Now, everybody in the world is on the spiritual path because it's all part of one creation. But when we put our will, our volition behind it, then we're on the spiritual path. When we really, really, really want that, then we're really seeking God. Now, how common is that? Not very common. In the Gita, Krishna says, out of 1,000, one seeks me. And out of 1,000 who seek, one perhaps finds me. So if you kind of translate that into statistics or population, here in this country, let's say if we have 400 million people, so there are somewhere around 400,000 people who are seriously seeking God. That means the people in this room are, assuming that we're all doing that, we have a very rarefied atmosphere of consciousness. This birth is very, very rare. In fact, I want to read this little quote that just came this morning from, I am part of a group that gets a newsletter from a disciple of Ananda Moy Ma, and every month they send out news and stories about Ma, but this she said, men and women are equally endowed with the capacity for realizing God. It is the supreme duty of each human being to impart full worth to this birth, which is a rare boon, by engaging in God remembrance. Otherwise, they will continue uselessly in the round of births and deaths. Pretty apropos to today's subject. So, according to that desire, how strong that desire has come, we build up karmic patterns, and they go back lots and lots of lives. But for the sake of making it simple, let's think of the patterns of the last 100 or so births that we've come. Now, if we're seriously 1 out of 1,000 people seeking God, we have been doing that for many lifetimes. Certainly, I would say the last 100 lifetimes. So we've had spiritual samskars, but we've had more than just spiritual samskars. We've had other desires, other karmas, other thoughts. Every thought, Master said, thoughts are things. They aren't just evanescent. They're things with their own energy and their own reality. So every thought, every desire is a thing with its own energy and creates patterns within us. So how did we get here? Well, let's start with what happened at the end of our last lifetime, because that's where it was predestined that we were going to get here. So we'll talk about the dying process, what happens as we leave the body, more on the class on Wednesday of death. But I want to talk a little bit now about the moment of death, what happened then. So at the moment of death, our energy withdrew from the body, our life force withdrew from the body. The fact that we're here and not merged with God means that when that life force withdrew, it left the body through the medulla. Also connected to that is the medulla is connected to the outer ira and pingala. And so as the energy that which is connected to the breath, so as the breath ended, the last breath, the energy came up the ira and pingala to the medulla, and we went out through there. So I remember Dr. Peter saying, I see him out there, he said, the cause of death is the same for everybody. We run out of oxygen. We cease breathing. It's why we cease breathing that keeps doctors in business. But so we ceased breathing. The life force withdrew. It withdrew from the medulla. At the time that it withdrew, we had a life review. And that life review reviewed everything that happened during this lifetime. Now, this is all done in consciousness, isn't done kind of little checklist and you did this, you didn't. Everything that you've done is kind of instantaneously there in your consciousness. Now, Master didn't say this, but I remember Damian Brinkley, who was one of the people who had a near-death experience and wrote about it. He talked about his near-death experience when he died. He actually died and then came back to life. He said during his life review, he saw every act that he had done in this life, but he didn't just see the act. He felt the emotion of that act, and he felt the emotion of everyone that was affected by that act. He himself had been a sharpshooter, a sniper is the word for the army. So he was, and he had killed many people. He saw the effect on them, on their families, on everybody, in as if his consciousness were completely raw. And all of that impact was enormously magnified. And he went through that life review. And in that life review, as he went through, there came, forget him now, it comes back to us. In our life review, as we finish that review, there comes into the consciousness a certain kind of pattern of desire or of regret or of feeling that there's unfinished business. And whatever is there, that dominant thought at the time of death sets the pattern for this lifetime. So where you left off in your last life, what you felt was unfinished, what you wanted to do, what desires you had, that predetermined the conditions for your birth in this life. Now that's what happens for almost everyone. It does not happen for the enlightened yogi. The enlightened yogi does not leave through the medulla. He leaves through the spiritual eye. What does the spiritual eye represent? The spiritual eye, I keep looking around because most temples, we've got a picture of the spiritual eye. But you all know what it looks like. A golden field with a golden kind of rim with a blue field and a five-pointed white star. Why is it that? It isn't something, some artist's conception. It's actually the projection of the Sushumna, of the interior of the spine, the astral spine. And so the medulla is the negative pole of that, and the projection of that, the spiritual eye, is the positive pole, because we have not yet in our last life learned to control our life force sufficiently to bring it completely into the Sushumna. We can't perceive that spiritual eye clearly enough to exit through that spiritual eye. Gives you a hint of what we're going to talk about on Wednesday, because the final exam is to learn how to exit through that spiritual eye and not through the medulla. When we do that, we merge with God. Otherwise, we have a rebirth that is going to come about. So the last time, we did not make it quite and be able to project through the spiritual eye, but rather we left through the medulla. But the very fact that we wanted to leave through the spiritual eye is an enormous, enormous victory. Remember, Master said to Norman, remember, it takes very, very, very good karma to even want to find God. Wanting to find God is not even as far as advanced as wanting to merge with God and really dedicating your life in a certain sense, dedicating your life to achieving the ability to exit through the spiritual eye. So all of our practices are meant in order for us to be able to control our life force at the time of death sufficiently so that we don't fall back through the medulla, that we exit out through the spiritual eye. But let's come back to what happened when we do exit through the medulla. Then we go in, Master said, to a kind of subconscious rest period. He didn't say how long. I think it varies. But that subconscious or deep rest, it isn't subconscious in the way we think of our mind subconscious. It's a period of deep, deep rest, where all of the trials and difficulties and stresses and all of these problems that we've dealt with in this life vanish. And we just are able to, it's Hawaii times a million. And we get this deep, deep rest. And then according to our level of consciousness, our intuition, we awaken on the astral plane. Now, people who have very undeveloped intuition aren't even really conscious of the fact that they're awake on the astral plane. More developed intuition, you're aware of the world that you're in, and according to how you've led your life, it's very much freer and more magnetic, things drawn together by magnetism is what I mean. So according to what you have, the way you've led your life, a shifting process goes on, and you're on a certain astral plane that perfectly fits your consciousness. I'm convinced that those of us who've spent many lifetimes trying to perceive the spiritual eye, trying to unify our consciousness with God, we awaken onto an astral plane that is extraordinarily beautiful. Master, in many, many different places, has talked about it. But there is weather on the astral plane. He said the winter, the higher beings on the astral plane never feel uncomfortable with warmth or cold. But the winter is beautiful, beautiful. He said that rain or snow, rain comes down like flower petals. And it is not only, but flower petals lit from inside. And it not only rains visually, but the sound of the rain is like a symphony, the most beautiful symphony. Everything is conscious. A rose on the astral plane turns and bends, and it draws its sustenance from your appreciation of it. And so as you appreciate it, it responds with fragrance. You eat on the astral plane by walking by a tree and thinking of a fruit, and the tree materializes it for you. And so you don't really need to eat in the same way. It's all light, it's all vibration and energy. But this beautiful, beautiful experience on the astral plane. Now, I'm also convinced that many, many of us were together on the astral plane. See, this last 100 lifetimes or last dozen lifetimes, whatever you want to think of it, we have been following Master for a long time if we're really, really drawn to him in this lifetime. And because of that, we've incarnated with him. We've incarnated with William. We've incarnated with Alfonso. We've incarnated with Master, maybe not with him, but in his family. And that family vibration affects us much, much more deeply than our physical family did. And so that vibrational unity, I'm sure, has drawn us to inhabit the same astral plane together and to share this beautiful astral open consciousness. And that is why, in part, we have such a desire to recreate that on the physical plane here, why we've drawn to do community, but not just to do community. Community can be done in hundreds of different ways, but the desire for harmony, the desire for beauty, the desire for graciousness and consciousness and the love of plants and animals and seeing the animals come awake and feel valued and safe. And so the deer come out, and if they stay out of the gardens, they're well loved. But here we have that astral desire that's carried over into this lifetime. And so we have on this life the opportunity to pick up from just where we left off, just those patterns that were left as we exited the body last time and lived on the astral plane. Then after some period of time, when we're on the astral plane, the thought arises or the desire arises to come back and have birth on the physical plane again. Now, if your desires are strongly physical, you'll be drawn back more quickly and more, with less volition. We had a friend in the early years of Ananda who had a good sense of humor, and he said, well, when I die, I'm going to have to incarnate the next day because I'm not going to be able to go without my coffee and cigarettes. And so if we have desires that are of a nature that have to be fulfilled on the physical plane, we're going to be drawn back more quickly. But if our desires are for things like beauty or harmony or spirituality or those kinds of refined desires, we don't need to come back to this plane to fulfill them. They're much more easily fulfilled on the astral plane. But since we did, let's take it as a given, unless there are some very sneaky avatars sitting in the room. Take it as a given that we had the karma to be drawn back into the physical plane. And so we came back, but where did we come back? Why did we come back? How did we come back? So birth takes place when the conditions are right, astrologically, and we've finished our time on the astral plane. Now, for many people, that time can last hundreds of years in terms of earth time. But for yogis, it can be faster because yogis want to get back here because we can make spiritual progress faster on this plane than we can on the astral plane. Why? Because we're driven to do so. On the astral plane, things are so nice that you don't have very much motivation to change. Here, things aren't so nice. You probably noticed that. And so you have a strong motivation to improve. You have that strong desire for more happiness. As it gets more and more refined, it's the desire for bliss, the desire for union with God. And that, for yogis, brings us, I think, a little more rapidly into that cycle. As Ma said, this birth is a rare birth. As Krishna says in the Gita, rare indeed is that birth into the family of yogis. Or really what he's saying there is that birth where the conditions are there from early childhood for you to continue that spiritual search. So we come back with a karmic pattern, with the desire to resume the search for God. Now, to a certain extent, we get things mixed up. We think that it's important what nation we were born into, what family we were born into, what kind of occupation we're going to have, what kinds of friends we have, what kinds of, whether we're wealthy, whether we're poor, good health, bad health. We'll go into that much more tomorrow. But frankly, those things don't really matter. When you were ready to come back into this world, you were kind of looking for a compatible set of circumstances. That means parents who at least shared some very strong trait for you. And when they united, and when the sperm and the ovum came together, then there was a flash in the astral universe. And I've always kind of enjoyed this image. Those who were in tune with it kind of rushed to get into that womb of that mother. And in some cases, there was a tie and twins came. But at any rate, so we're drawn into the circumstances by which we can continue on our search. But it isn't very important whether we're born in this country or in Brazil or in India or those things are not too important. It isn't very important whether we're born in a rich home or a poor home. Those things will happen kind of automatically. The conditions that we have created karmically will be met for us, the potential for those conditions will be met for us at the time of our birth. And then we come into this lifetime, and according to the pattern, you know, I've just talked about the last dozen or the last 100 lifetimes, but really it goes far beyond that. So we've had billions of thoughts and desires, probably hundreds of billions, and that's just the little galaxy around one chakra, you know. So we've all of that complex karmic pattern, we come back, and our karma is set. What's going to come to us in this lifetime is pretty well set. Anandamoy Ma, Swami said some years ago, that he asked Ma about karma and free will. How much free will do we have? Swami has said, we don't even really have the free will to choose what kind of tie we put on in the morning. It's that choice is done for us karmically. So those outer circumstances that we think that we can control, we don't really control very much of that. Anandamoy Ma said, we are on a train, and we have the ability to move to the front of the train or the back of the train, and that's about it in terms of our free will. Master put it that we have the free will to seek God or not seek God. And so there's just a little tiny bit of free will for us, and all the rest is karmically determined. That's why, in part, Bhrigu or Agastya can predict way far, far, thousands of years into the future who's going to come into a room when, because that's karmically determined. So the events of our life are pretty well determined. But what is not determined is how we react to those events. I was thinking about that statement of Anandamoy Ma's, because when I first heard it, I was kind of depressed. I thought, now that doesn't seem fair, that we don't have any choice at all. I mean, we're on this train, we're stuck on the train, we can't do anything about it. But I was meditating last week on that statement of hers, and the fact that we can move to the front of the train or the back of the train, that is everything. Who cares what the train's doing? you're going to be riding some train anyway. The ability to move to the front or the back of the train means that we can control the direction of our energy. And the direction of our energy is absolutely everything. Think of it here. We could take a snapshot right now of everybody in the room, and we would get one static moment. We could take a snapshot of everybody on the earth right now in one nanosecond, everybody, so it's completely static. What does that tell you? It doesn't really tell you very much. You see different shapes, different people, different circumstances, all of that. That's all karma. But if we could see the direction that those people are headed, wouldn't that tell you a whole lot? So the direction that you're headed in your consciousness is everything. Are you headed toward God, or are you headed toward the world? All it really means is that karmic pattern. Remember when I was beginning, I said that God has done it very, very, very simply. Everything that you do because you think it's going to make you happy. Your karma is really the pattern of those thoughts and desires that you think are going to make you happy. But the fact that you think something's going to make you happy is a given. That's the way the universe works. So everybody is working with those desires. You and I are working with desires. But what is the pattern of the desires that we're working with? Now, if we're working with a pattern of desires that we think our fulfillment lies in something that's on the physical plane, or something even more universal that keeps us separate from other people. If you want fame, how can you have fame unless you have separateness? If you want wealth, all of the things of the, if you want security, all of those desires, you know, the, think of the different chakras, which I won't go into, but each has its own, you know, the base is kind of survival. All of the desires that you might have that interplay with survival, if the pattern of those desires is that you think your happiness will come from something that will allow you to survive, then that karmic pattern is going to be at play. Now, you might think that wealth is going to help you survive. You might think that possessions are going to help you survive. You might think that power. There could be millions of things that you think consciously or subconsciously are going to help me survive. As long as you have the desire to survive, you'll come back, because that desire is born of the ego. It is the ego that wants to survive. The soul doesn't want to survive. It knows it can't die. Master said, don't pray for immortality. Why pray for something you already have? So we are immortal. The soul knows that we're immortal, but the ego doesn't know, because it's in Maya and separation. And so it thinks that its happiness comes in part from some sort of survival strategy. Your only real survival strategy is the spiritual eye, not the medulla, and not anything that pertains to the ego. But that's the process of spirituality, is that we gradually find that this doesn't satisfy me, I don't want that anymore, that doesn't, I don't want that anymore. Finally, it begins to sift out and sift out until we don't want anything that draws us into separation anymore. All we want is unity. And when we want that, there's still momentum. We still haven't crashed into the light of the sun yet, because there's still some momentum. But as Ananda Moy Ma said, it's as if we've pulled the plug on the fan, and the blades have to spin a little bit more, but there isn't power going into that system anymore. We've pulled. So at the very, very least, our job in this life is to pull that plug, is to get to the point where our pattern of desires, our innate pattern of what we think is going to produce fulfillment, is nothing that pertains to separateness, but only unity with God. And that, finally, is the only thing that can ever, ever possibly fulfill us, because it's where we came from and where we're destined to go.